What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Managing Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, 4chan is dead. Or is it? We don't know, but it's certainly down on the Internet. And we'll be talking about its impact. It's a very popular and notorious image board. We'll talk about like what that all means and kind of what 4chan, how 4chan influenced the Internet overall and the world, I guess, at this point. Because it kind of feels like we're living in a 4chan poster's paradise. And it's really, really sad to me. Also joining us is podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
I have a lot to say about 4chan, and then I'll disappear.
Okay. And also, we'll be talking about 20 years of YouTube. It is YouTube's 20th birthday this week. And
I've
talked to a lot of people.
Interesting numbers. 4chan interesting. And 20 years of YouTube, just saying.
Are they auspicious or not?
I don't know. Is it April 20th yet? Oh, it's past April 20th. Oh,
it's wow. Past April 20th, yeah. It is now April 24th. 20 plus 4, I don't know what that means. But yeah, we'll also be talking.
They're all powers of 2, that's important.
Yeah, we've got thoughts on YouTube. I kind of remember where I was when all that kickstarted. And a lot of people talking, I talk to people now and they're like, feels like YouTube has always been here. YouTube is so ingrained in us and in the culture. So yeah, we'll dive into all that. But as always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We've got a good listener email this week, actually, and that's great. Please send more stuff. And also, something I will say is that I think like some of these listener emails could also filter over to the new Ask Engadget section we're doing back at the site now, too. So it can go all over the place. We love your feedback. We love your questions. And I think we just love to nerd out and help people with technology problems too. Like it's just a fun time. So please send us your questions, podcast@engadget.com. Join us Thursday mornings around 11 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. And we'll show off gadgets when we have them. Nothing this week. And we'll do some Q&A with the audience. Let's get right into it. The 4chan hack last week, I think, was kind of weird because it came out of nowhere. And what really happened is that it seems a rival image board took them down via some sort of PDF hack. So took the entire 4chan like architecture down, but also doxed some things, including information about users and moderators. And some of the moderators had .gov email addresses, and that makes us feel all sorts of weirdness. And I think now is a good time to kind of take a step back. I wonder if the youngs even understand what 4chan is for the internet. What is it? It's an image board. It was it's sort of like a old school forum before the forums like really before they started to look like real time chats. Before it looks like the chat in YouTube or something. It reminds me of the old CGI chat days, and that's it. It's a basic ass forum. People posted memes. It was an offshoot of the Something Awful's forum, which itself was kind of a hellhole. 4chan harkens back to old school internet days. Like I remember when I was in college, people were posting there. But even for me, like when I started on the internet, it was like mid-90s. I think by the late 90s, there are already these sorts of sites like Rotten.com. Do you guys remember mm-hmm. Rotten.com? And that was a site of just like the... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I thought I liked Rotten.com. I can remember the yellowish, goldish logo, right?
I don't know if there was a logo, Sherlyn. I remember you click Rotten.com, you kind of close your eyes a little, and you click forward, and you will see the grossest.
I'm thinking of Cracked.com, maybe.
You're thinking of Cracked. Cracked is a fun time. Cracked is fun. Fun meme.
I was like, I really liked Rotten. No, Cracked.com.
No.
Go on, sorry.
Rotten.com. was just like, hey, we have this global website. Let's put the worst shit you can ever imagine. So it was like photos, like horrific photos from accidents, all sorts of stuff. Just like the stuff where I think if you're trained to be a cop or a doctor or something, they probably show you this to desensitize you a little bit. But you kind of go there and you're like, oh, you just want to throw up immediately because it's just gruesome gore, but also all sorts of random stuff. And that's kind of, there was that side of the internet from the beginning. I feel like it just kind of festered to the point where people were doing it for fun too. Like the 4chan started as like a meme board, but the meme also ended up being a little trolly and a little, I don't know, ironic to the point where you could pretend to be racist and then you kind of just lean into the line of being racist. Ben, I feel like you've touched the land of 4chan at some point.
Yeah, Yeah. I stopped going there after I could be tried as an adult.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting how it feels like all of the worst impulses of the internet that you were talking about. I don't know if Rotten.com was the place where I lost my childhood innocence in middle school, but it was like a website that was similar to that. I was seeing stuff that was definitely like not really appropriate for like a seventh grader to be seeing. Somehow I managed to miss a lot of the gore. I never saw Pain Olympics. I've never seen an ISIS beheading or anything. Yeah. But a lot of the people I know did. And I think it still affects them to this day. And all of that stuff kind of distilled down into the culture of 4chan, which is scary in its own way.
And it also felt like competitive. Sherlyn, like, are you aware of, like, I'm sure you know what 4chan was, but were you ever a participant in its insanity?
4chan was never, like, targeted for people like me, right? Like, it often made notes and jokes about people like me, right? Like, I mean, it's, there is, I think, a section of it. I saw screenshots from 4chan, I think, on other forums, sometimes on Reddit. Like frame it like ELI 5 question for you guys would be like, what is the difference between 4chan and something like, say, Anonymous? 4chan is a forum, Anonymous is a group, but like, did they have similar sort of vibes?
I mean, it was sort of separate things, but anonymity was certainly a big part of what 4chan was, yeah. Right? So like, you were fully anonymous, you weren't signing up for accounts, and also the threads would disappear after a while. So they were like the Mission Impossible, you know, missions that are being delivered, like, this will self-destruct. Yeah, basically. So like, you can do something terrible, it'll go away and it kind of won't be traced back to you. But then people would screen cap that and then share those around, and those lived on because that's memes work because we share them, basically. Yeah.
You could actually say that Anonymous was organized largely on 4chan.
That's the vibe I got too, yeah.
So there's all that, yeah. How did you guys hang out on the internet? That's the question I was wondering. Like, what did you do when you first hit the internet, and kind of what circles did you move in?
Okay, so this is really interesting. I spent a lot of time on YTMND. You're the man now, dog.com. The little single-serving sites that, like, I don't know how to explain them to someone who's never seen them, but it was like a way of making subdomains to this one domain that used like big kind of like impact font meme text and then also like tiled images. And so many of those memes that were found on YTMND either first cropped up on Something Awful or 4chan. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to go to 4chan to begin with, because like YTMND was one of the first places where I was like spending a lot of free time after school online. And eventually I found out like, oh, actually, this is a site that's downstream from the actual meme factory.
Yeah.
I wanted to go see the source.
You're the man now, dog, by the way. The source of that is a quote from the movie Finding Forrester. Sean Connery telling...
I still haven't seen Finding Forrester.
You should see Finding Forrester. But what really coalesced all this for me is that I went to college with the kid who starred in Finding Forrester. So wow. Rob Brown was in my... And it took a lot of self-restraint for people not to be like, not to always be shouting, "You're the man now, dog," at him. Like, I feel like, I'm sure if you were him at this point, you would be sick of it, because I think he was aware of like the memification of all of it. That movie's fine. That movie's perfectly fine. Like, you know, somebody trying to save a kid from the inner city, basically. But that line just kind of lived on forever. But I don't know, for me, like, it was always like, yeah, you would do things online and find like-minded groups. And for me, it was like anime fans. I was in Sailor Moon chat rooms early on, the mid-90s. But I think like everybody has experience of like something crummy happening online. Either you get in like some sort of meme war with somebody, or somebody just makes you angry. And it feels like 4chan is an escalation of that too. I think I remember at some point somebody was like trying to tell me The Outlaw Star was a better show than Cowboy Bebop. And I would not stand for it, because it's not. It's not on any level. It's not. Please back me up, chat. But those were the sorts of wars, innocent stuff around fandom. And then by the time we got to 4chan, it was like metastasizing into full on really bigoted stuff, really ironic, like sexist stuff, and then metastasized to the point where it does kind of feel like you look at Elon Musk and the way he posts on Twitter and the way he kind of jokes, that feels like 4chan adjacent. And I think the moment he bought Twitter, just kind of that stuff's mainstream now. Like the guy who owns Twitter is kind of a 4chan baby, basically. And it feels like the way President Trump tweets and sends messages, like it's kind of the same sort of railing forum shitposting. Just kind of a weird world we're living in. So I want to point that out.
But at a certain point, like, you don't know whether or not it was directly influenced by 4chan or if it was just like in the culture of the internet.
This is true.
You know, you could say the way Trump does communication could be affected by 4chan, but he clearly has not spent that much time
I'm talking about more like cultural osmosis, basically. And I think, like, to a certain degree, like, circles took in a lot of that messaging, certainly right-wing groups. And I think, at the very least, like, what Trump is very good at is taking the way, using messaging to his advantage at all times, at all many platforms, all sorts of things. There's a great piece from Mr. Ryan Broderick, who we wanted to get on the show, but he's off gallivanting around the world. But he wrote, 4chan is dead. Its toxic legacy is everywhere over at Wired. And this is an idea I was thinking about before I read this piece, but he really consolidated it into a nice piece about his own experience in 4chan, but also the idea that our politics, our media culture in so many ways feels like it's kind of where it is. When you see the White House producing social media videos of being like, let's meme the chain gang of prisoners we're sending to, you know, prisons in Latin America. It's hilarious, isn't it? It's kind of how I've been feeling. Sherlyn, any thoughts?
Like, who thinks that's hilarious? Yeah. It comes from
the shitposters.
A 4chan impulse.
The article you mentioned, Devendra, really crystallizes what you were just saying, right? Like, Ben Collins, the Onion CEO, told Ryan Broderick that, as he sees it, once Elon Musk bought Twitter in 2022, there was really no point to 4chan anymore. Why hide behind anonymity if a billionaire lets you post the same kind of extremist content under your real name and even pays you for it? I mean, like, and the article, Ryan goes on to say that, like, this 4chan vibe of, like, I guess toxicity is just everywhere now. It's like on YouTube comments, it's on Reddit forums, it's on Twitter or X, it's everywhere. So basically what you were saying just now, right? But, like, you spelled out even more clearly, I guess, to me article.
It's funny because even Ben Collins, where he is now, that guy, he was a former he was a misinformation, disinformation reporter at NBC. And then he, because of, like, this business opportunity came up, like, he was able to basically take on the mantle of The Onion, which is a satirical news site, or was, like, which was a site, a paper devoted to just delivering silly things. But now that is weirdly an arbiter of truth because of the world we're living in. Like, we're living in The Onion in a way. And I don't know.
I wish that every disinformation reporter could have such a nice retirement plan. This is such a great way to rehabilitate someone after having to stare into the dark heart of the internet for as long as he has.
Yeah. So there's still a lot we kind of don't know about this hack. I believe there were posts by the current owner, Hiroyuki Nishimura, who's owned the site since 2015, that they do intend to, like, bring back 4chan in some form. But from the reports I saw early on last week is that it seemed like everything was screwed. Like, the core database, it seems like the architecture behind 4chan has not been evolved or worked on in almost a decade. You go to 4chan, it kind of feels like Craigslist, you know, just really basic links and images, and that's all it is, except it's sort of a hellscape, too. So it could very well come back. I don't want to say it's going to be gone for good, but it does feel like kind of the end of something. And what killed it was a rival image board that that didn't even intend to, like, become a big thing. So it's just, it all kind of, like, comes together. Like, all this feels unintentional, and just, like, the sheer movement of social forces on the internet has, lifted up another image board to take down this one. Who knows if 4chan will come back. And I don't know. We don't even need it anymore because this is 4chan is everywhere now, right? It's in Twitter. It's in our group chats. It's coming from the White House. Hey, fun times. I don't know.
It's in Gen Z slang. It's in Gen Z slang.
Yeah.
Based, pilled, all of that stuff basically came from the manosphere, and like 4chan threw a bunch of lighter fluid on that. It's everywhere.
I still don't understand based fully. You know, I get all of it, but based.
This is something that we'll talk about later on, but we need to move
because
on.
Because so
YouTube.
Many things can be based. It's like you don't actually have a clear, you're just saying based. You're just saying a word.
Yeah, you don't know anything about Lil B, but it would take too long to explain the rapper Lil B to you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that too, I know. We know pilled because I am a product of the Matrix era and how the right wing kind of took that the wrong way. But anyway, that's 4chan. We'll probably be talking more about this eventually, like especially if they come back. Let's talk about a slight, I don't know, a brighter side of the internet, although it certainly had its dark parts too. Let's talk about YouTube, which turned 20 this week. We put up a piece called Engadget's Favorite Videos from 20 Years of YouTube. And there's some classics here. People put up, like, their favorites include, like, The Warm Cozy Cabin with a Relaxing Fire, Canadian Please. I remember that. The Carl Lewis National Anthem Fail. I remember all of this. Dog of Wisdom. Oh, man. So many fun things. Greatest memory of YouTube for both of you.
Yeah, that Canadian Police was my submission that you mentioned. I don't think that was like the greatest memory, but I do say in that blurb that like I cannot remember one single example of like my favorite YouTube moment other than my secret vlogging channel that nobody should go search for. Where like one video I made that looked like it was a lyric video suddenly started taking off. And then suddenly got like 200K views, which for me back then was a lot. It was like in the 2010s, that was a lot. But yeah, no, I was like, a lot of my critical like internet video moments too weren't YouTube video moments. They were like flash video moments. Like the End of Z World is one of my absolute favorite internet moments. And yeah, it's not a YouTube moment.
Before YouTube, it was really hard to get video on the internet, like in general.
Yeah.
Like there was Real Player, which was really fuzzy, crummy streaming video. There were flash animations, but I believe YouTube was initially based on the ability for flash to run video. I think that's kind of the way things were. Yeah, that was like FLV, I think. But yeah, that was like 2005 when YouTube hit. Yeah, we're celebrating 20 years now. I do kind of remember how remarkable it was because I'm somebody, I think I've been such a lover of video on the internet for a while. One of my favorite things I used to do was go to Apple's trailer website, and they would have huge QuickTime versions of movie trailers, and I would like love to download those because they would just have them up there and you could go frame by frame and get like gorgeous photos for your backgrounds and stuff like that. But that was like the best video could look, but it took forever. Like you need to have a really fast
connection.
Data
download.
They're like 300 to 400 to 500 megabyte files. Like they were really big files. So I was in college with broadband and like that was good. It was still not enough to like sit and stream those videos. You still had to download them. So like YouTube arrived as more people around the world and certainly in America were getting broadband. That was kind of a big thing. So we were able to suck down video better, but also the quality of the video looked so much better than the stuff from Real Player. It was a real
confluence. Remember the buffering. The like you had to hit play and then hit pause and then wait, and then come back and hit play. That's
fine. I remember I wrote a piece for us too about the history of video streaming. It was like 95 or 96 or something. And like I saw an ad in a magazine that had like a really long URL. It's like, go here to see a trailer for Mortal Kombat. And I typed in all the letters and the tilde and everything, and it took like 5 hours to see a postage stamp, video, less than 320p, like really, really.
Yeah, I was about to say, what was the resolution on that?
Less than like VGA, like half VGA resolution, basically. Like I don't know what that would be
when
like.
People on TV would say HTTP colon double /// www. As their full URL.
That's when
until like way too late in the game too.
And also people weren't simplifying simplifying domain names or making like putting your stuff in shorter directories. No, this was just a trailer that was in like four or five directories deep and they just published the whole URL that you had to type in. But anyway, that thing looked like garbage. So by the time YouTube came around, it's like, oh man, we can have decent quality streaming video that's easily shareable too, because it was built to be a sharing platform first. And then Google bought it, and then it became like the stream, like it's everything. It is like the ultimate. You can find any video there. Just like you
learn
go to Google anything. And you
learn CPR, learn sign language. Yeah.
Learn anything. If there's any lessons, like you, me, Sherlyn, and Ben, too, like we should have just done, let's call it all in on YouTube in the early 2010s, because all this schooling and training for actual work, I don't know. This is all falling apart. People aren't reading words anymore. They're watching stuff on YouTube, right?
It's so funny, though, because when you see people post online and they say, like, you know, thank God for American YouTubers, they will teach you to do any stupid little task.
Right.
And then also, like, thank God for Indian professors posting all of their lectures online. And so you could get a whole education on YouTube just that way.
Just that way. Fix anything in your home, like something wrong with your toilet, you'll find a YouTuber who's kind of done that for you.
And in a lot of cases, they will be an American person. They will show you how to plug a USB Type B cord into a printer. Literally just like put peg A into slot B in case you've never done it before. And yeah, that is kind of like a silly little SEO play, but you'll see that this video has, you know, hundreds of thousands of views. Obviously, people were wondering about this.
Yeah. So I think as a technological achievement, like it's hard to even say like how much of an impact YouTube has had. I've talked to people who are like, oh, YouTube wasn't always here. Like it's only 20 years old. It feels like it was here since the inception of the internet or something we've always had. I highly, if you are a fan of YouTube, I do recommend the premium subscription, because the ads are kind of what kills the experience for me. And that's why I like was never fully into it before. But to have full access to like so much content of the world with no ads, that's worth it to me. To me, it's one of my most valuable video subscriptions, and I have many. But there are also downsides too, right? There are so many downsides to YouTube. Go ahead, Sherlyn.
There's people in the chat saying that there are parts of the world that don't have ads on YouTube and therefore don't have YouTube Premium. And that's just that. Suku in the chat, I believe, says they're in India and they don't have ads and therefore no premiums.
That is wild to me.
Nice.
Yeah.
I took it differently. I thought that Indian YouTubers are straight to the point. Like, they're like, okay, let's just get straight to like what we're talking about for this. And then they're not running the clock for the ads.
A few comments up. If you look before, you said to Tom Rogers, there's just one thing that says, Suku says YouTube doesn't run ads in my country. And then the comment you're referring to, Indian YouTubers are straight to the point, which is also another point where the in-video ads, the narrated, integrated ads, right? Those apparently culturally don't seem to exist because Indian YouTubers don't say that.
I've seen a lot of long videos out of India, especially like those uncles who basically, I'm going to cook a whole meal for a whole village and everyone's going to eat. And I love those. I love watching those
on Instagram reels.
Yeah. Good stuff. Like anybody can be a star basically because of YouTube and all these video platforms. The downsides we're talking about, there were a lot of issues around censorship, a lot of issues around moderation and the content YouTube delivers to people, especially when it comes to kids. YouTube is still a hellscape for kids. Even though YouTube Kids exists, there is still like a weird rabbit hole of things you can go down. Like there are these videos.
Can you confirm or deny whether Cocomelon was made in response to that scary YouTube, like Elsa and Spider-Man go to the doctor? Like those videos feel AI generated, but it was like a little bit before AI generation was a thing.
They're just like brain empty videos, I think, that they think would appeal to toddlers. Like, I'm glad we never got into the Cocomelon stuff, but there are things that are really compelling to kids. Like, you like watching videos of Paw Patrol or Peppa Pig? Then the videos will eventually go away from official content to like, oh, these are just people playing with Peppa Pig figures, but it's anybody, it's just random folks playing with them. And I kind of don't want my kids just to watch videos of people playing with toys. And then there are the ones of like the YouTube families where the parents basically just make the kids stars, and it's these rich kids and like freaking in Russia and also Russian families in like Saudi Arabia, I think, who have way too much money. And the kid's just like,
okay, I thought you were going to talk about family vloggers, but go off.
No, I'm not even talking about the family vloggers. I'm just talking about people who create these weird content where it's just kids playing and they're clearly like Russian or something, but it's just kids playing in sheer opulence who have all these fun toys and all these different things. Family vloggers are whole other things. My kids like Kid Crew, and they seem pretty wholesome because it's like a DIY family and the kids build toys and they fix Hot Wheels and stuff. Like, you learn stuff. You feel like you're getting something out of that watching this family play together. But there are also so many who are just like, the parents are just putting kids on videos because it's making them money too, right? The impulses of a money-making platform is that people will keep doing it and do more and more extreme things to make money because the algorithm rewards it. It's not a human paying you. It's Google's algorithm who's determining the value of your videos and redirecting people to you and things like that. So, you know, a lot of downsides.
Also, let's take a second to talk about how smart someone at Google was for saying, hey, you know what? We should buy YouTube. And then they sat on it for like a good close to a decade.
What do you mean sat on it?
And I remember seeing all of these like news articles about how much money YouTube was losing year after year. But someone at Google was like, hey, actually, there's a lot of possible ad inventory that one could put here. We just need to figure out how to do it. And once they did, oh man, did the money start flowing.
Interesting. Yeah. I remember because I was seeing like 2015, I see Business Insider piece saying YouTube is still not making Google any money. I don't know if they really sat on it, but they certainly didn't. YouTube is a slow move. Google is a slow moving company. And they had a whole business.
I think it was also difficult to implement something on like a site that had so very quickly become a public utility.
Basically, yeah. Like, it became the internet's playground for videos. And they didn't want to screw up momentum, probably. I have not seen a good interview about that. But yeah, Google had based also its entire business on advertising. So you have to think like they were planning some sort of ad play thing at some point. But yeah, I'd love to see the full story there.
I also think that it's interesting that this Engadget article focuses on singular videos.
Mm-hmm. Because the anniversary is of the upload of a video, not the actual YouTube anniversary. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Thank you for the delineation. Gotcha. But it's we can actually maybe cut the history of YouTube in half or so, where it was the singular video era up until maybe the mid-2010s, and then the YouTuber era a little bit after that. And a lot of the people that I interact with online who are younger than me really experience YouTube through the creators that they follow, not just, you know, the one meme video where this guy wearing a wig says shoes a bunch of times.
And, that was one of my favorite shoes.
I wanted to mention that.
I bought
some
shoes. Oh, that was so good.
So good. Oh. It took the rise of social media, right? For the YouTuber, for the influencer to become a thing. And it is kind of a thing I'm fighting against now too, because when I tell people what I do, like parents, you know, to my kids' friends, like, yeah, sometimes I make videos on YouTube. And the kid's like, oh, you're a YouTuber? No. My stuff, I do make things for YouTube sometimes, but that's not how you describe what we do. Yeah.
I think what you're both bringing up is that YouTuber may become an occupation, and the second half.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I mean, it is.
It is. Yeah. Second half era that you're talking about is that the growth of YouTube becoming a feasible career, as opposed to back in the day when social media manager was a nebulous title that all of us were like, what on earth is a social media manager? And now it's a full fledged career path for a lot of people. So
it is, and people still look down on it, even though it's no, that's
except for random commenters online who still call it the intern when it hasn't been an intern for 10 years.
You can tell
now
when people don't. They say the intern of this company did this. You don't understand how anything works. It's not, interns have no power at all to do anything. That's typically how it goes. But anyway, 20 years of YouTube. I don't know where things are going to go. I'm certainly kicking myself for not producing more video content and doing the bad things of sitting and learning to write better and, learning how to report on businesses. That's not serving me. so much anymore, unfortunately, because you could just be a YouTuber and just say whatever you want, apparently, and you'll get the views.
Writing helps for writing scripts.
It does. It does. But I don't think people want scripted YouTubers. People want your person. They want like the off the cuff personalities and stuff too. Like, this is all stuff we're seeing and stuff I'm hearing from people who also produce content from YouTubers. If you sound like you're reading from a script, for a lot of people, that feels like a turnoff, which is weird too. But anyway, we're in YouTube's. YouTube is almost, what's the official founding date? But from its first video, it's almost old enough to drink.
There's the YouTube founding date, and then there's the date Google bought it, I guess.
Yes. And then the date of the first video went up too. Like, they're all separate.
Yeah, I think it's April 23rd, 2005.
Was the uploading, right? And then February 14, 2005, it was founded in San Mateo, California.
Yes.
Because it was by Steve Chen, Chad Hurley, and Joed Karim. They were employees of PayPal, which, by the way, if you're thinking about like Silicon Valley, how many people used to be from PayPal? I will not say.
How many people used to be from PayPal?
Yeah, but I can't remember when, that Google bought it though.
It's probably there. It's fine. It's fine. It was a couple of, it was actually pretty quickly, like after all that happened.
Exactly.
I think Google immediately saw the sort of impact that YouTube could have. We're going to embark on another era of YouTube, I think.
When? November 2006? 13, 2006, that YouTube was bought by Google.
I remember. It was like really quick because there was Vimeo at the time. There were other things. We're like, YouTube. Google seems really, really desperate to buy this YouTube thing. But I think they saw the potential there immediately. Now we're in the era of short form video, right? And I do spend a lot of time, like when I have downtime, like I can just zip through a couple TikToks or something, or Instagram live videos, not as much of those. YouTube Shorts feels like it took them a long time to kind of get there. I don't think they fully understand how that platform works too. It feels like YouTube is the place you go for like long stuff, official stuff.
Yes.
And then the kids go to TikTok or wherever, or Twitch. Twitch, all the gaming stuff went to Twitch. YouTube failed to really grab gamers. YouTube gaming was a whole thing they had tried to do and poach over streamers. Didn't really work out for them. So, you know.
Is YouTube gaming still a vertical on YouTube, or is it in the Google graveyard?
Is it in the graveyard? I don't know. What happens when you search YouTube gaming? I'm sure they just kept. Yeah, they have a whole thing. It's still like YouTube.com/gaming. They have a whole section. That doesn't
cost
them anything.
Sections are not things that are like worth, I guess, retiring. You know what I mean? Like, it's just you leave the link up and leave the tag page up, I guess.
I don't think they have the program where they were paying a lot of people. Right, Microsoft did this too with, the Ubeam? Whatever their thing was, the Microsoft streaming thing. That. They had bought that thing and then spent hundreds of millions to kind of bring people over to... it feels like YouTube is a constant, even if all these other new innovations will pop up, because where else are you going to go to find, like, you know, you're going to find the latest trailer for the movie you want to see on YouTube, right? You don't have to go to Daily Motion. You don't have to go to Vimeo or wherever. And it's actually easier to search in YouTube rather than searching on Google to find certain things sometimes. So, like, YouTube feels like this forever thing. I just hope Google doesn't do something to mess it up, because Google seems to love doing that. Let's move on to other news. And yeah, the big other news is also Switch pre-orders just kicked off last night at Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and a whole bunch of other places. I tried to get one, because I know I probably shouldn't have told my daughter that a Switch 2 could be in her future. She's doing really well at school. But anyway, I tried, and every single site was having a lot of issues. I saw people on social media who were able to get through and get stuff at Best Buy and elsewhere. Did you guys try?
I sure did not, because I was like, it's going to be a mess. Also, it's at midnight. But I did jolt awake at like 4 a.m. this morning for no reason. And I blame the Nintendo pre-order servers.
Did you try?
Are you asking me? I did not try. After I woke up, no. I just couldn't go back to sleep. I blame it. You know the like Black Mirror thing where there's a server running my brain? The server crashed, and therefore I couldn't sleep anymore.
There was a disturbance in the forest.
Yes. There was a disturbance, yeah. I also want to point out, like, we were waiting for price changes or anything. Yeah, they didn't change the price of the console or the games, but accessories are basically going up around $5 each. So the camera is now $55 instead of $50. The Joy-Con 2 controllers are now $95 instead of $90. And the original Joy-Cons were already so expensive. So, you know, that's kind of how Nintendo's dealing with whatever mess is coming down with tariffs. Let us know. Did you get your Switch 2 pre-order in? Was it easy for you? I tried. I tried for like half an hour to get something in across multiple sites, and everybody was kind of failing. It was a mess, but apparently it worked for some people. But yeah, drop us an email, podcast@engadget.com. Next story, Apple and Meta have been hit with the first fines under Europe's new Digital Markets Act. Together, that's around $800 million. Let me see here. Apple has been fined 500 million euros. Meta has been filed 200 million euros over anti-competitive activities. We have a story about that on the site. I feel like we're going to see a lot more of this. And also, I saw a story this morning. The Trump White House is also saying, like, they are not fans of this extortionary practice from the EU against American companies. So will there be further retaliation? I don't know. Tariffs upon tariffs? We'll see.
Okay, I can't.
Yeah. He does not understand being punished for doing bad things, unfortunately, but of course. In other news, other news, OpenAI said it would buy Chrome if Google's forced to sell, which to me feels like a nothing statement. But do you guys have any thoughts on this?
I giggled. I found it really hilarious, but also Perplexity indicated interest as well. So all these AI companies flush with investor money right now, barring the markets, seem to be very interested in taking Chrome. So, you know.
I think they're salivating at the point of having like this captured space, basically.
Yeah.
Where, oh, people are.
You have to wonder what they'll do with it if they do have it, right? Like everyone's like, right?
For Google, Chrome was an advertising vehicle. Basically, like you've basically viewed the web entirely through Google's lens. For these AI companies, it would kind of be like what Microsoft is trying to do with Edge. It'd be like, hey, we got this little AI buddy here.
Right.
Everything you do, you're always using it. Yeah.
It sucks for me because, like, in my opinion, I have a soft spot for Chrome because Chrome was the best browser for a while. I mean, again, thinking back in the Netscape Navigator days. But Chrome, therefore, does have a huge, like, market share in terms of the browser market. So I don't know what that would mean for anyone that takes over and buys it. I certainly don't want an AI company taking over a browser that I still continue to use as my main, right? Like, so it just makes me feel, I giggle, but it's also kind of, it makes me feel icky.
It's icky because we're at the whims of all these companies with way too much money, right? And basically they will dictate culture. Google was kind of a savior from the old style of browsers because Chrome was clean and fast at the time. And Firefox in like the mid-2000s was getting clunky as hell. Firefox was itself an offshoot from the original Mozilla browser, but also Netscape Navigator. Like that's the direct line there. Firefox was facing a lot of trouble. Now Chrome has become the memory hog and also the thing that's like killing your computers, but that's also because we're doing everything online. You know, like I'm currently streaming our videos to produce a live stream
through
from
browser?
A website, you know, from a browser. I record other podcasts in a browser, which locally captures my audio and sends it either to my computer or to cloud storage. So the browser has begun doing so much too. So that kind of makes sense. In other Google news, it was real that Google's paying Samsung an enormous amount of money to pre-install Gemini on phones. That's no surprise because that's what they did with search and Apple and everything, right? Do you have any feelings about that, Sherlyn?
I just always wondered why Samsung was so happy to keep working with Google, even though it also had its own solution. And this makes quite a lot of sense.
You want to keep Google's a key partner for them, right? Like Samsung gets
they collaborate closely. Yeah. I just always thought that was like a mutually beneficial, like Samsung kind of admitting that its AI is not up to par yet and that Gemini is the way that Apple also uses Google's image search in its visual control feature. I now think that, Google probably is paying to be part of that, right? Like
For sure.
Yeah.
Nobody really loves Bixby or whatever the heck Samsung is working on. So it's all about Google Gemini, I think.
Yeah.
We also saw the story about the Washington Post partnering with OpenAI to bring its content to ChatGPT. Washington Post originally was one of the, I believe, outlets really fighting against OpenAI taking their content. Ben, you and I were talking about this a bit, you know, as we were planning the show, and I kind of feel like this is something that's going to happen with every media outlet, because these AI companies are going to be hoovering up your content no matter what you do. So it's kind of like you might as well make some money from them, while doing it. But I also saw a response from a former Washington Post reporter this morning who was like, they were worried about what this would happen. And apparently the AIs are now generating false articles under their byline as working at the Washington Post. And this was somebody who had worked on it was a history reporter. And they had told, I have to pull up their name, but part of their job was they never want to equivocate history. They never want to both sides the Civil War or anything like that. And that's essentially what the AI did, and use their byline and the legitimacy of the Washington Post to be here's why the South may have been right about the Civil War. That's the sort of stuff we're opening up.
Oh,
yeah. That's
With their byline?
With their byline. Oof. Yeah. So this is what we're worried about. We don't control this stuff, man. Yeah.
The thing that we were talking about, though, is given that so many people have started moving from Google to ChatGPT as just a way of asking a more complicated question and getting a big, long answer, at least you might have some better quality answers with Washington Post citations. Because what OpenAI and ChatGPT might end up doing if they didn't have this partnership is they would take the same information, but they might not credit Washington Post, because then that would be grounds for a legal case, probably.
This feels like sane washing hallucinations, though. You're creating false information. Now you're putting the Washington Post tag in somebody who used to work there. So if you Google this person used to work there, this is probably their reporting. I don't know. To me, this is a nightmare. Shalyn, thoughts?
I truly don't know. It's hard to predict these things. We were just saying that 10 years ago, social media manager wasn't a job. 10 years ago, YouTuber wasn't a job, and now they are. This is kind of where, I think it's going to be silly now, but I don't know. 10 years from now, 5 years from now, what's going to happen? It's AI going to be AI writer, AI feeder. Is that going to be the future job title?
Prompt engineer.
Exactly. Is the prompter, so
they did it within a month of ChatGPT launching. It's I'm an expert at this thing that just existed a couple weeks ago.
Well, yeah. How else are you going to have 10 plus years of experience when people are asking for it in 3 years?
Yeah. It's all getting worse. So anyway, we're going to keep an eye on this. But this is why I am so skeptical of these AI companies pulling in actual content. And there has to be pushback. There has to be a fight for truth, which I think we're kind of losing with all these AI tools. Let's move on to what's going on around in Gadget. We have a review of Clair Obscur Expedition 33, that amazing looking RPG with a sort of really dynamic battle system. Matt Smith reviewed that for us. He liked it. He called it an original hit RPG. It's a beautiful game with dramatic heft and satisfying combat. I cannot wait to play this thing because I have downloaded it to my computer via Game Pass. It's been sitting here, but it didn't unlock until 3 a.m. last night. So hope to get some time with it. Shalyn, this may be a fun game for you if you want to get into RPGs. I don't know. You said you were going to be a gamer because Xbox is coming to your TV, right?
Yes, Xbox is coming to your LG TV starting this week. Sure. I think I have an Xbox controller unopened in my closet somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. My best RPG right now is Animal Crossing still.
That's an RPG. That's basically an RPG. That's an RPG. That's a life sim. Islander. Yeah, Roku also had an event this week, which I believe we attended, right? And they unveiled two new battery-powered security cameras. Again, I don't know why, but Roku was trying to get into the smart home and they're producing cameras. Feels like everybody's producing cameras now, and maybe we should be careful about mixing your ecosystems. That actually may be an advice thing we gotta start thinking about. And also they unveiled two new streaming sticks, the Streaming Stick and Streaming Stick Plus, and they say they're 35% smaller than the competition. And that's all they have. That's really all they can do now, because the other sticks had everything. They had 4K, they had Dolby Vision and HDR. You can't add anything else. So all you could do is change the size, I guess. Yeah.
I found it really funny. Yeah. I was at my partner's place and they used an Amazon Fire TV stick or something. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we just watched this on Max. Let me sign into Max. And there is no Max app for Fire TV because they want you to subscribe through Prime. And I was just annoyed. So I'm going to get them a Roku TV, streaming TV stick.
How is there no Max app on Fire TV? Yeah.
I searched. There was HBO Now, which obviously no longer exists. And then Max, which they prompt you to subscribe through Prime. Tell me if I'm wrong, if I got this wrong.
Amazon, the app is there. I don't know. Maybe it didn't give you an easy way to sign in.
No, it just, maybe I went to the app store and I was like looking for the Max app. So maybe that's there's weird. A software update that they need to do, yeah, but I don't know.
That is weird.
But that just stunk of like too much, you know, it's very like control-y, right, to me. Yeah.
I hear you. And what was the other news? There's the projector that launched this morning, which I like. I saw it. Nebula's new X1 4K projector. Nebula is the sort of premium projector brand from Anker, a company we really like because they make good batteries and all sorts of cool stuff. Let me see here. Dan Cooper wrote the report. It's supposed to be reliable indoors and out with a peak brightness of 3,500 lumens. Triple laser unit with 4K UHD, Dolby Vision. That's really bright. It should fit a 300-inch screen. This is actually pretty crazy because I have like a theater from I have a projector, which is also a laser projector, but that thing costs a lot. And it's also not nearly as portable. This thing is $3,000, which is what my projector costs.
$3,000.
There's a lot of tech in here. Triple laser projection is a really, really complex thing. So it is wild that they have put this in a thing with a handlebar.
Yeah.
I would not buy a $3,000 projector to take outside. You know, I would buy like something much, much cheaper and a freak rainstorm or somebody spilling a drink on it. I would not worry so much about. But this is wild. We should test this at some point. It's liquid cool, so that's cool.
I was going to say we are planning on reviewing it. There is a last minute thing I would like to add to this list because it is now past 12 p.m. and I can talk about it on the live stream. but Declan on our chat's like, it's April 24th. Did Motorola release their wooden Razr? And so, yeah, there are new Razr flip phones as of 12 p.m. Eastern today. You can find Sam Rutherford's story about the new Razr Plus and Razr Ultra, Razr series of foldable screen phones on Engadget.com. But yeah, there's three now. I don't believe there is a proper like wooden version.
I see like a wood background. It's a wood grain. It's an Alcantara back.
Harkening back to the days of like Moto phones that look so good, right?
Yeah.
It starts at $700 for the standard Razr with like not the like super big screen on the outside, I don't believe. But yeah, I mean, news in foldable phone land that would have probably taken up more time on this episode had it not been under a embargo.
Just dropped. All right. Well, thank you for that. And yeah, check out all of our stuff at the main site. Go to the website, Engadget.com. Let us know like what you're, if you want us to cover things that you're not seeing there, drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. You can also do that to send us listener questions because we have a great question here from Jim in Bainbridge Island, Washington. I love Bainbridge, by the way. I love going there whenever I make a trip to Seattle. I've gone there a couple times with my wife. It's a ferry ride over from Seattle. Lovely little town. And this is, they're basically asking to Mac or not to Mac was the subject. They're a Gen X Windows user. They've been building their own system for decades. They work mainly in 3D design for building and construction. Would like to know if switching to Mac makes sense with all this unnecessary tariff turmoil. One of the pieces of software they use, Revit, does not run on Mac Silicon right now, but everything else that they use does, like Rhino, Vectorworks, AutoCAD. So here's the real question. I feel like I need someone to just tell me to go for it and not look back. With everything going on in the world, I feel like I should gear my and my family's life towards being more mobile and stationary if I decide to we've had enough and want to move abroad. So they think the MacBook Pro seems like it makes the most sense. And they've been also been using a MacBook Pro from 2015 that they were gifted a while ago too. So I immediately sent Jim an email and be like, yes, dude, just go for it. Because if most of your software is supported, you can learn the basics of how to use a Mac. It's not that tough. It is something I'm bringing up as I review Mac laptops now, because there is a learning curve for Windows users. Like, I bought my wife a MacBook Air, and she's still like figuring the shortcuts, the copy and paste stuff. She's still like trying to wrap her head around. I've recommended Macs to people I know who are slightly older, like my co-host Jeff Cannata on the Filmcast. He's a geek. He's built computers. He's been in Windows forever. And still the idea of jumping to Mac feels a little intimidating to him. And I'm telling him this. Go ahead.
Can I admit one thing? Remember how I was ranting a few weeks ago now about switching to Mac?
Yep.
I have gotten used to the Mac shortcuts, right? I figured them out. There are just a few buttons too many to
do. There's like three buttons shortcuts you have to press. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, now that I occasionally go back to my PC still to do personal life things, my fingers are like relearning everything, and they're kind of the PC shortcut, which I still think is my innate happy place. It's like, oh, it's not as beautiful as I thought it was before. It's a muscle memory thing at the end of the day, right? It's
basically, you have to learn different things. Yeah.
Yeah. And then once you learn it, you get used to it. It's not as bad as it was. I still do hate the like Windows sort of app setup on Mac.
It's awful. I agree.
Why can't you just make the app windows float, lay on top of each other nicely? I don't know. But
it's the thing I will never get over, and Mac users like come up with all sorts of like third-party tools to manage it. Apple has given us Center Stage and different things to like sort of like reshift like how they deal with Windows management. But I will maintain it's a nightmare. I like just having a taskbar where I could see everything and also individual windows. So that's what you want. The dock is not it. We got to move beyond the dock, damn it. And every time review Macs, especially OS X or Mac OS, I'm like, the dock was cool 25 years ago when OS X first launched. It was cool that you could see a video preview in the dock, but I need to see individual windows, folks. So, Sherlyn, I hope you're playing with Exposé or like the floating around windows, because that's what I do. I make hot corners in all my Macs, and I drag my mouse to the top left, and it opens all the windows for the current app I'm using. I drag my mouse to the top right. It blows up all the open apps. And then you see the windows. I never hit the dock. Just never hide the dock. Never touch it.
Yeah, I never use the dock either. I do realize that somehow on my work MacBook, somehow I've set it to like if your mouse hangs out over the top right corner, it just goes to sleep.
You got to tweak your hot corners. And that's a cool feature that used to be called Exposé. But yeah, you probably have that down to sleep. Anyway, yeah, you have this experience, Sherlyn, of like trying to get into Macs as a mainly PC user. I like the changes are tough. I don't think the entire Windows interface is as good. But you know what is good? Having killer battery life, having the sheer power that they've put into like the Apple Silicon chips. I feel more confidence using a Mac out and about, like a MacBook Air. I know I close that thing, it will be in standby for a long time.
I have the exact opposite experience. This is so weird.
This is weird. But I take an Asus ZenBook outside or a Surface or an XPS. I'm like, I hope Windows is smart enough to kind of keep this power, but it does not always work. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I have the opposite experience, which is my Windows laptops sleep and they come back and they still have like 50% battery. This MacBook that I've been using, an M1 MacBook, to be clear, goes to sleep and then the next morning is dead. Or like,
is it the work MacBook?
A few hours later is dead, even if I left it fully charged.
Is it the one issued by our IT department, Sherlyn?
I will talk to our IT department. And it is one issued by our IT department.
I think our work, I probably just need I've to noticed issues. I think our work MacBooks have severe battery drain. So I think like there is something happening because of like
background.
Whatever IT people put in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can't sleep because IT needs it to be running for all the time.
Speaking of battery drain, would you trust running some of these very, very intensive and power hungry modeling programs on battery alone?
You would be connected to power. Like you're not going to run a big job on battery alone, but the Mac batteries, especially if you need a lot of juice, the MacBook Pros last a long time. The 16-inch lasts even more. You could totally do some jobs from there. But also, it's easy enough to just plug in and get that going. My one suggestion to Jim was just be careful about how much you spec up in terms of RAM and storage and everything, because Apple gouges you a lot. So think carefully. Like it's like an RPG. Do you want to put your experience points in RAM or do you want to put them in storage? What is more important to you? If you're running big projects, it could be RAM is the thing you actually need because it's unified memory and that memory goes to the video card too. So it may allow your projects to, you know, render faster if you have more video RAM. So that's my thing there. This is a great time to get a Mac. And for even somebody who's like very Windows trained, the MacBook Air, I still look at that thing. I'm like, wow, you are just the ideal computer. You're just doing everything we need. Occasionally you can encode video. Occasionally you could do some serious work. You could play games on it. Try doing that with a $1,000 PC. Go ahead.
Jim, thank you for this. What I'm hearing out of all this chat is that you should consider a new MacBook. However, I am inspired to have us do a what to do after you switch from Windows to Mac series of guides or tutorials. Like, what to know? What are the shortcuts you map over? What are the third-party apps you need to install to get the Windows to work the way you want? Like, just that sort of thing. I'm going to start putting it together, and Devendra and I, we can work together on that for you.
Yeah. It's
not just for you.
Yeah.
You know, but you're an inspiration.
For sure, Lynn. But also, the IT guy in me is like, yeah, this is, I remember training really old professors like, yeah, you got to drag this thing to the applications folder. You're not, there's no installer. But also conceptually, that makes more sense to just take a thing and drag it to where all the applications are. That does make more sense rather than double click something and it's throwing DLLs and registry entries all over your computer. Like,
yes, it's just ridiculous to me. I'm just like, why can't you just double click it? Okay.
I mean, you can run it from within the wrapper usually too. So that's the whole thing. Yeah. Macs try to be more intuitive. Let's skip what we're working on because I think let's get to our pop culture picks. What do you got for us this week, Sherlyn?
I thought I had two things. I've been playing a game that is part of YouTube Playables. Talking about YouTube. Called State.io. And it's I don't know how to describe it. It's basically like almost like Go, but I really don't know how to describe it. But it's a fun, like, mind-numbing game that isn't too difficult or too easy. It's just like the right level of challenging, but also like mind-numbing. So if you're, you know, ever looking at YouTube games, I think everyone has a YouTube app that's on your phone. State.io is a fun one if you're ever looking for a time killer. My actual pop culture recommendation is, I think 2 weekends or 1 weekend ago, my partner and I saw Warfare in the theaters.
Yeah.
And it was a ride. It was quite the ride. As someone who knows various members who are either vets or like themselves about to be deployed to Iraq, this was a very difficult watch for me. Warfare is the story of a unit of, I believe, Marines that were part of the, I forget the name of the actual battle. Let me pull it up because
it's a 2006 really battle, the Battle of Ramadi.
Of Ramadi. I was really trying my best to wipe this from memory but it stuck with me. But it was extremely painful to watch. Now, it's a war film directed and written by Ray Mendoza and Alex Garland, based on Mendoza's experience during the Iraq War as a Navy SEAL. It stars like actors like Will Poulter, Kit Connor, Joseph Quinn, Charles Melton, Noah Centineo, DeFaro, Wunatai.
Charles Melton comes into this movie like Superman, doesn't he? He's like, I'm here to save you, all of you. And I look beautiful because I'm Charles Melton.
It's really, this cast is all of the internet's boys.
All the boyfriends.
Yes, it is.
Right,
it really, Charles Melton, I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Because Charles Melton enters a bit later in the show. You have to imagine this is like in a reclining seat theater, and I was just either curled up in a ball or like hands to my head the whole time. It was just in pain. And then Charles Melton shows up and I'm like, wait a second. Like, I am no longer in pain. And I'm just like, oh.
All better. Did you ever see May December? Because I recommended it to you, Sherlyn.
Yeah. That's, I think so. It's the one with the two women. Yeah, Charles Melton's in it. Yeah.
He is incredible in that. Like, it was like Oscar.
Very good in
for
it.
Him.
What
did you overall think? Yeah.
Of Warfare, right? Yeah. So again, like, because I have like people who have either gone through similar things personally in my life, this was a really tough watch. But the sound design, I'm hearing a lot of people say, was really good. And I agree. I think the sound was so immersive that it made it feel even more real, and like I felt like I was right there at the scene of what ends up being a very gory situation. Like, to be clear, like, a bomb goes off. It was also very like a gripping story, very emotionally like told. I think it was like I was very wrapped into like the various aspects and perspectives of this specific incident. You can see the U.S. Navy SEALs, Marine, their side
SEALs.
Of it.
Yeah.
You can see. Right. You can see the side of the people who are fighting them. You can see the side of the people, you know, commanding them. And then the sides of the people who are either supporting them or being pulled into it from the outside. It's really just really good storytelling, you know, for a story that I didn't think would be that interesting going into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an experience. You watch this movie for the sound design, mainly, too. I forget if I talked about it here, but I saw an early screening here where Raymond Doza was there. It is a really interesting film and a really, like, immersive war film. It reminds me of, like, Black Hawk Down, where it's just soldiers in trouble and they got to get out. And that's kind of the story. It's really bare bones. It's also an experiment from Alex Garland in sort of his sort of, like, minimalist narrative, which he kind of did with Civil Very War stark. As well. Civil War is a great, great film. I generally like that one, too, even though it's hitting a little too close to home. I do kind of wonder about the perspective of this movie. That's all. Like, it's we're still dealing with, like, the basically the reckoning of the Iraq War and everything. And I don't think this movie fully does it, because we never – this movie involves also destroying the home of an Iraqi family. And that felt kind of weird. There's a weird point in this movie where the family is just, like, looking at the remnants of their home. And people in my audience started laughing. I'm like, huh.
Oh,
that's interesting.
That's weird, because my theater, we didn't have that reaction. I was very much like, yeah, these idiots, how dare they destroy the home? So that was my reaction watching it.
That's
right?
Good, because,
like,
you're a person with a moral center and a soul, Trillin. So yes, you reacted appropriately.
The audience you were with is not good.
Which included a lot of Marines. It included a lot of service people.
Really?
So, and that's my thinking. It's like, yeah.
Mine included the local fire department somehow. Okay. And they all showed up. And I was like,
they all go to the screenings together. It's an interesting movie. I do wonder, like, the perspective, because it's so, like, neutral in a way. It kind of lets people attach whatever motivations they want and everything that's happening. And it feels kind of rough, because I lived through how we dealt with the Iraq War, and it was not pretty. And the downsides of that, I mean, affected American soldiers, but really affected the Iraqi people, too. So, yeah.
You're right. I like that. I like that this show, mm-hmm. therefore, shows you the sort of person you're talking to, what perspective they left with.
That's interesting,
because
my
partner was very much like, wow, they let the two locals go first or something like that. Like, very much like they threw the locals under the bus.
That? Yeah.
And I was like, because you're a good one.
They were essentially, the two Iraqi translators, let them go first. Let them die first, because they're just cannon fodder. Anyway, interesting movie. I'm glad you saw it in theaters, because this movie would not hit at all at home if you're trying to watch it through even a sound bar or something. So great, great movie. I want to mention Andor season 2, which I was lucky enough to spend the weekend just, like, marathoning the screeners. We reviewed it for the sites, and it's good. Andor is good. It's fantastic. And I think kind of a tribute to revolutionary thinking and how rebellions are formed and how they occur. And it feels like a show very much meant for the moment we're in America and the world as a large. So anyway, if you liked Andor season 1, you will love Andor season 2. And it definitely made me cry at the end. Like, it is just, this is the best adult Star Wars we've ever gotten. It is a shame that, you know, this is the end of the story, because we know what happens to Andor back from Rogue One. But it also feels like, I hope Tony Gilroy, who's the creator of the show and who's the person who kind of swooped in and saved Rogue One from, like, a disastrous production, I hope he gets a chance to, like, do more within the universe, because essentially this is barely a Star Wars show. This is really a story about rebellion and how people fight back against fascism. That's really what it is. There aren't any lightsabers. There's, like, a minimal amount of mention to the Force. But there is, it's barely Star Wars. It's just using Star Wars trappings to tell a really good story. But yeah, everybody check it out. And I'm sure. Are you watching The Last of Us, Sherlyn?
Oh, not yet. I'm waiting for more episodes to come up, and then
you should probably catch up right away. Okay. You should probably catch up right now, because people are going to spoil things for you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you should catch up right away.
Cool. Okay. I will do that. I have one last question on this topic, on this pop culture topic for you. Did y'all talk about Black Mirror? Last week?
I think I mentioned it last week, but yeah, it's fantastic. I loved every episode.
Season. Every episode was a banger, in my opinion.
Yes. Yes.
Do you have a favorite? What's your favorite?
My favorite is the Paul Giamatti one, which is so heartbreaking.
Right. It was a very good one. That was a very good one. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite, mine is the Hotel Reverie one.
Hotel Reverie is good. Bette Noir
was, like, low on my list until I found out Netflix was also gaslighting its own viewers. And I was like, that's incredible. That's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Twitter, and, you know, Blue Sky, where I spend more of my time. And podcasting about movies and TV at The Filmcast, thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me your favorite pieces of CSS or JavaScript or PHP, you can send them to me on Threads... or via email, really. CAGR at engadget.com is fine. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. And subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.